WBUR. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The thinking among some persuasive Washington hawks goes like this. Much of the world is now prospering with democracy, except for much of the Middle East. And Iraq can be democracy's doorstep to that region. Bring democracy to Baghdad, and you open the Mideast to a wave of democratization from Kabul to Beirut. It's one of the driving impulses behind support for an American invasion of Iraq. But will it work in Iraq or beyond? This hour on Point, democratic opportunity or mirage in the Middle East. We begin tonight with Washington's latest plans for governing a post-war Iraq. Earlier this week, it was reported that the White House National Security Team is deep into assembling its final blueprint for an occupation of Iraq after Saddam. The plan calls for at least 18 months of U.S. military presence and civilian oversight to take Iraq from dictatorship to fledgling democracy. David Sanger of the New York Times broke the story. I asked him how close the White House plan is to final approval by President Bush.
Tom, they are. There are a whole series of task forces that have operated throughout the government, the State Department, the Pentagon, a number of other agencies, all feeding into the National Security Council. Those have come together into a remarkably detailed set of proposals about what one would do with Iraq once Saddam Hussein was gone. And it works, of course, on the assumption that he would be gone, either voluntarily or involuntarily.
Give us the outline of that plan at this point, David.
Well, it's got several features. The first is that there would be a military commander, either General Tommy Franks or one of his subordinates, who would be responsible for security. Now, initially, the plan called for that commander to basically be in charge of the whole country. When we reported that in October, and it sort of raised images of a MacArthur-like figure, then the plan shifted a bit, and now the thought is that there would be both a military and a civilian commander.
And with the division of responsibilities being?
The military commander would be responsible for security, the civilian commander for rebuilding the country, getting the oil fields going again, getting the schools going, developing political institutions.
So this is a U.S. military figure and a U.S. Civilian administrator, or U.N. or Iraqi, do we know?
Not yet decided. My guess is that it will either be U.S., or UN or coalition, and my suspicion is, and this is more based on body language than what anybody said to me, that if they could find a non-American to do it, that they think that would be politically more palatable. Mm-hmm. Now, another part of the plan is to get the oil fields running, and that raises all sorts of interesting legal questions, including whether or not an occupied Iraq would have a vote at OPEC, whether it would have to observe the production controls and quotas that OPEC imposes on member countries or votes on for member countries.
And David, what's the plan, the thinking there? Is it to get the oil fields under control, A, so they're protected, B, so they're producing revenue? And is that revenue imagined as a forward-going resource for rebuilding Iraq, or is it also imagined to pay back the American treasury for the cost of whatever military action might be
there? There's no discussion of the latter. The only discussion I've heard of is using the oil fields to pay for the reconstruction of Iraq. And you'll hear administration officials, when they go on TV, repeat a phrase that's in their talking points, that the oil is the patrimony of the Iraqi people. Mm-hmm. This is their effort to diffuse accusations in the Arab world, and some here, that this is about oil and about gaining access to oil. Now, of course, oil is a fungible commodity, and as soon as Iraq is producing, then it reduces American dependence and the rest of the West's dependence on other Arab states.
And also could put downward pressure on oil prices, hypothetically. What about Saddam's government that would remain after his departure, death, whatever it might be?
Well, the thought is twofold. First, that there would be war crimes trials, but only for the most senior officials around Saddam, and Saddam himself if they caught him, although that seems hard for you and me to imagine. Mm-hmm. The second is that they would give some kind of lenience to senior members of the Iraqi government who helped the U.S. and the coalition in whatever military action came about, who helped the U.N. inspectors. So there's a way of saying you can get time off and you can get leniency if you step forward and help now. And, of course, this is an effort to drive a wedge between Saddam and his more loyal members of his government and military.
Which brings up an interesting question. U.S. forces are mounting in the region, but we're told there's still an ardent hope that somehow Saddam will be overthrown or go into exile, somehow something short of war. If there's not an invasion, if there's not a war, and Saddam would be overthrown, or if he went into exile, do U.S. forces still go in? Does this plan still pertain, or would the U.S. just sit back and allow whatever happened to happen in Iraq post-Saddam?
That's an interesting question, and I think it depends on how it happened and whether they were invited in or not. One of the big U.S. concerns is that Saddam not be replaced with another dictator. A second concern is that the country not be broken up into three pieces, and of course it's not a natural country, so one could imagine it being broken up. I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. went in under either case. You hear American officials talk about Saddam voluntarily exiling himself or ceding power. This isn't a strategy. It is a hope. To some, it's a fantasy. But I don't think it's anything that anybody's betting on.
You've written that the CIA is planning for all kinds of receptions for an American force, from friendly to hostile. What is the expectation at this point?
You know, people have different ideas. I'm not sure what they're worth, because in different parts of the country, it could be a different answer. Up in the north, where Saddam really doesn't control the territory right now, I think that they probably would be fairly welcomed. Around Baghdad, I think you have to assume there's going to be a significant amount of hostility. So I don't think there's going to be a single answer for the entire country. This gets to a question of whether or not you are dealing with a occupation similar to the one that we saw in Japan, where in 1945, troops were basically greeted, and a new government structure was pretty well welcomed. And Tom, you and I both spent a lot of time there and know that that left a legacy for 50 years. But there are Somalia-like comparisons as well. And it all depends on who you talk to.
And then there's the issue of duration and transition. You write that the military is planning on being in Iraq for at least 18 months, a civilian administrator perhaps longer. What's the time horizon here, and how do people envision a transition to Iraqi self-rule, and what kind of self-rule?
Well, I think that what the administration does not want to do is set up a provisional government using the Iraqi exiles so there was a government ready to go in place, because what that would do would basically take out of the running Iraqis who are within Iraq right now and can have no form of political expression.
Could be alienating to everybody inside Iraq.
Right, and it's not at all clear the exiles would be particularly welcome back in Iraq. So the position the administration is taking is say that they would welcome a government formed by free Iraqis everywhere. You know, then we ask the natural question, well, could you please name a free Iraqi for me in Iraq?
Right.
And their answer is, there aren't any now, but there will be soon. So I think that they don't want to be in the position of appearing to choose a government. But at the same time, Iraq is not a place where it's immediately clear to us that democracy would naturally take root. And these things are not predictable. I mean, in 1945, people had the same questions about Japan and Germany. And it turned out that they developed two democracies that are very different from each other, but we would call both of them democracies.
But in the plan going in, do you perceive, do you see a firm American commitment to attempt to institute democracy in Iraq?
Yes, I see a firm American commitment to attempt. But democracy is not something that one can force on people. I would assume that the version of democracy you would get if you get one in Iraq would look different than, say, what you're getting in Afghanistan.
David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Sanger covers the White House for the New York Times. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. We are talking tonight about dreams and democracy in the Middle East. Powerful voices in Washington have described Iraq as the springboard for a wave of democratization in the Arab world. The people of Iraq can shake off their captivity, President Bush said when challenging the UN to hammer out a tough new Iraqi resolution in September last year. He said they can one day join a democratic Afghanistan and a democratic Palestine, inspiring reforms throughout the Muslim world. With America's guiding light, this view sees democracy sweeping across the Middle East, or at least uses that vision to help justify intervention in Iraq. But is democracy really the greater goal here? And if it is, does it stand a chance if it arrives on the heels of U.S. troops? Can the U.S. bring democracy to the Middle East? Can it afford not to? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Marina Ottaway, Senior Associate and Co-Director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good evening and welcome, Marina Ottaway.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you so much for being with us. And with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you right here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here, and hello to our guest.
Marina Ottaway, you have looked closely at the prospects for democratization in Iraq and beyond in the Middle East. Give us your top-level analysis of the Bush administration's stance right now on democracy. We've heard an awful lot about the prospects for democracy, the opportunity for Middle Eastern democracy in the last 9 months or a year. Is it front and center on the agenda now? Was it ever? And if it were, can it work?
Is it on the agenda? I think the desire for democracy is on the agenda. At the same time, the Bush administration at the present time cannot afford to promote a democracy in the Middle East wholeheartedly, because if it is going to invade Iraq, it's going to need the support of a lot of regimes in the Middle East that are not democratic, beginning with Saudi Arabia. So what we have seen in the last few weeks is a change in the rhetoric emanating from the Bush administration, redefining democracy, moving from this concept of democracy sweeping through the Middle East as a wave following the overthrow of Iraq, to the idea that democracy is going to be a long-term process that starts with more education with people in the Middle East, more rights for women in the Middle East, but certainly not a sudden change.
So there's a kind of pragmatism setting in here, but Marina Ottaway, you know as well as we do that some months back that pragmatism was not so front and center. There was a powerful faction in Washington talking about this kind of joyful scenario of the tsunami of democratization. Was that ever realistic? Could even now people talk about Iraq kind of kicking off a democratic domino effect in the Middle East? Is there some reality to that?
I don't think there is much reality to it. The faction, particularly within the Pentagon, that supported that idea is certainly still there. The idea of a more gradual transition to democracy comes from the State Department, and it was outlined by Secretary of State Powell in early December. But going back to the idea of whether the concept of a wave of democratization sweeping in the Middle East is realistic, I think the chances are very remote of anything like that happening. First of all, there is the question of whether Iraq itself is going to become democratic. I think we have heard David Sanger on that. Let me add just one point, that while the possibility of Iraq becoming democratic can never be ruled out, it's not going to be a quick process. It may take, even after the end of the occupation, even after, 18 months or 2 years or whatever of the occupation, it's going to be a long time before we have, even in the best case scenario, before there is anything like a consolidated democracy.
And yet, Jack Beatty, we all heard the table being set for months with this drumbeat, a kind of euphoric anticipation of the kickoff of democracy in the Arab world.
Yes, and it's given the Bush policy a sort of Wilsonian, not to say messianic face. We're not just about oil. We're just not just about stability. We want democracy and to reign in a new era and so on. I think that we're going to hear that rhetoric again and again. And I think it represents, in a certain sense, one can understand why the stability we have now in the Middle East, which is to say autocratic regimes, is dangerous to us because Saudi Arabia and Egypt export their terrorists and because they have no local opposition. They don't allow any opposition. But on the other hand, democratization in the Middle East could mean Islamization. In other words, the two models are Iran on the one hand, an authoritarian state, you wait too long and then the lid blows off and you get fundamentalist regime, or Algeria on the other. You have an election and it looks like the Islamists are going to win, so you abrogate the election. So it's not clear to me that democracy, in our sense, is going to be necessarily in our national interest as opposed to a good thing for the Middle Eastern people.
And yet we looked at what happened on 9/11 and some Americans, Marina Ottaway points to the Defense Department, said, we cannot afford for this kind of political culture to go on in the Middle East that produces this kind of result for the United States, well, there it is. It's not easy. We're talking about democratic dreams and delusions in the Middle East. Do you anticipate democracy from Kabul to Beirut in a post-war Middle East? And can the United States successfully bring democracy to Iraq and beyond at bayonet point? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about democratic dreams and delusions in the Middle East. My guest is Marina Ottaway, joining us from Washington, D.C. She's Senior Associate and Co-Director at the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You are welcome to join us as well. Is it in America's interest to nurture democracy in the Middle East? Will Washington, would Washington, have the guts to stick with democracy even when it means Middle Eastern instability? Or will we turn again to strong men? And if we can't encourage democracy in the Middle East, are we doomed to see more 9/11s by furious, frustrated Arabs? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marina Ottaway, you heard Jack Beatty there raising the kind of horns of the dilemma here. On the one hand, some early analysis after 9/11 was that it was political frustration in the Middle East that helped produce this anger, this horrible outcome for the United States. We had to change that culture. On the other hand, we saw the Algerian example, and you've written yourself that one of the first responses to a more open political climate in the Middle East may very well be the rise of Islamists. So where do we go here?
Well, there is no doubt that at the present time, in a democratic election, you'd certainly have the rise of Islamist parties as a major political force. By and large, democratic political parties are extremely weak in the Arab countries. One, they have not been allowed to develop. And second, they have never figured out how to really speak a language that does make sense for the majority of the population there, mm-hmm. which is poor and which is very poorly educated.
So what about Iraq in particular? It's first up on the dance card here. Is it different? It has a more secular history. Do you see reason to hope that within some kind of time frame that Americans can imagine staying involved, democracy might be cultivated, might be planted in Iraq?
Well, the secular history in itself is not particularly important. Keep in mind that Algeria had a very secular history.
Sure
it had
enough.
Been a French colony for over 130 years, and Islam was pretty well obliterated in the country. So Egypt has a long history as a secular country. So I don't think that by itself is going to lead to democracy. I think in the long run, democracy could come into being in almost any country. The problem is we are not concerned with the long run. We are concerned with the short run. The question is not whether 30 years from now Iraq can be democratic. The question is what's going to happen in the next few years, particularly what is going to happen once a military occupation of Iraq is lifted.
I want to be very clear on this point. I'm sorry, maybe you're just getting to it. But do you believe that once that's lifted, sometime in the next 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, five, that some form of democracy could take root in Iraq, or are we back to depending on a strong man there?
I think it is very unlikely that democracy will take root that fast. The question is whether are we going to allow a new authoritarian regime to rise, one more friendly to us, or are we going to be forced to continue the occupation, either the United States or an international force, and maintain control on the situation in that country? For example, in the way we are doing now in Bosnia, there is widespread consensus among people who know that country that if you remove the international community now, the presence of the international community, whatever democracy exists in Bosnia is going to stop functioning. The question is, are we going to be willing to stay in Iraq long enough to force a new political system to take hold?
This sounds like far cry from a wave of democratization. Marina Ottaway, please stand by for a moment. Jack Beatty, I want to welcome into our conversation Joshua Muravchik. He joins us from Washington. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of The Imperative of American Leadership and Exporting Democracy, Fulfilling America's Destiny. Good evening and welcome, Joshua Muravchik.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Josh, in August last year, you wrote, "Change toward democratic regimes in Tehran and Baghdad would unleash a tsunami across the Islamic world, just as change in China will transform Asia." Are you still standing by that? Do we have a chance here to spark an age of political transformation in the Middle East, beginning with Iraq?
Well, I think we do. I think democracy now, weaker or stronger form, has taken hold over most of the countries of the world. That is, more than 60% of the countries of the world today have elected governments. We, of course, many of them are weak democracies or partial democracies, but still, the big majority of countries have freely and fairly elected governments. And this is a tremendous change only in the last few decades, and it means that the process of having a government that's chosen by the people has taken hold in places where people were just as skeptical about its arriving as they are today about the Arab world, that is, in a significant part of Africa, a significant part of Asia.
Well, true enough, but that change that you describe has been fairly well thoroughly resisted in the Middle East. Marina Ottaway more or less describes that view of a wave of democratization coming there as delusional.
Well, I know she does, but I mean it's been resisted in all these other places as well until very recently. That is, you go back just a few decades, you had a situation where the only democracies you had, more or less, with a few exceptions, were in the English-speaking countries and in Western Europe. And then you've had this immense transformation that really began, sometime in the 1970s, in which democracy took hold in Latin America the way it never had before, even though there had been democratic moments before. And then it took hold in southern and eastern Europe in a way that it never had before, and then in parts of East Asia and now parts of Africa.
And for all that, the Middle East has been so resistant. Take us beyond the kind of big tsunami talk and down to the nuts and bolts. How do you imagine, how do you foresee or anticipate this wave in realistic terms rolling over the Middle East?
Well, I think that want to strongly agree with Marina Ottaway about is that I don't think we can just topple Saddam Hussein and say, okay, we're going to hand over power to those few legitimate Democrats that are there, but that are mostly exile groups, and think that they'll just roll smoothly from there. I do believe that we need to make the commitment to stay in Iraq for a number of years, to not only change the government, but to sort of change the political culture, the way we did with our occupations of Japan and Germany after World War II. I think Iran is very near to a big change on its own, and I think our transformation of Iraq may be the itself may be the trigger that springs loose fundamental change in Iran. And oddly enough, even under its theocratic regime, Iran has had a partial democracy, or some of the features. That is, it's got an elected parliament. They have elections now. They have some partial political parties. They have a fairly lively press. I mean, the press gets clamped down on by the regime, but then the editors and publishers reopen with a different name, so that some of the ideas and practices that we think of as being, the essential skeleton of democracy are already there in Iran, and there's great hatred for the current regime. And I think when that regime goes, there's a very big chance that the Iranians will be ready, in fact, more ready than the Iraqis.
So there's the ferment. Jack Beattie, I want to get you in here. Joshua Muravchuk says, hey, he's not backing away from this tsunami. Surf's up. It's time. Let's not give up hope before we even jump in. And it can happen. It's happened in the rest of the world. So why not the Middle East?
Why not the Middle East? Well, I think if you say to probably if you go into the Middle East street, close your eyes and throw a brick, the first person it hits, and you say, what about the United States? We're going to introduce democracy. They'll say, you're about oil. That's all you care about. You're calling it democracy today. That's what you want here. Don't con us that it's anything else. And, you know, earlier we said, what brought about the 9/11 terrorists? Internal repression in the Arab world. Not that alone. U.S. intervention in that world. That's what brought it about, and the resentment of that. So what do these messianic Wilsonians say? Let's have some more intervention. And how long do they propose keeping the troops there? Well, let's look at the record. In the Philippines, they were there for 40 years, and then we had an authoritarian government take over. In Germany, they're still there 50 years later. In Japan, still there 50 years later. Do you mean to tell me that if we have an American army in Baghdad for 50 years, this isn't going to produce such a nationalist and Islamist reaction against the United States and against democracy? I mean, I just think that's fanciful.
Marina Ottaway, what are the early signs here? You followed the Arab press as Washington factions have been talking about the tsunami of democracy. What's the response been?
The response has been overwhelmingly negative.
Why?
What is striking is that there is not one article I have come across, and I have really done a fairly thorough review here, that suggests that the Arabs are taking the Bush administration seriously when it says that it's there to promote, that intends to promote a democracy in the Middle East.
What's the
critique? Explanations that are given are the U.S. is trying to cover up a grab for Iraqi oil. Mm-hmm. It's going trying to cover up its decision to give the Israelis a carte blanche in dealing with the problem of Palestine the way they want, or the U.S. is trying to establish its military hegemony in the Middle East. Those are the themes that come up repeatedly, constantly, in all the articles on these issues.
But maybe the people who have access to the presses in the Arab world are all in the pocket of the autocratic regimes there and are required to oppose American intervention. Is there another layer of society in some of these Middle Eastern countries that might welcome this, or is that fanciful?
Well, certainly you don't find it among the lower class, where the sentiments are very much in favor of the Islamist groups, and which are equally suspicious of U.S. intentions. No, I don't think there is a significant layer of public opinion in the Middle East that believes in the sincerity of the U.S. government in wanting to promote a democracy in the Middle East. And the Arabs tend to be very conspiratorial. I mean, it's the result of living under repressive regimes, and they are always looking for ulterior motives.
Joshua Muravchik, I hear you there.
Yeah, I think to talk about public opinion in authoritarian societies is meaningless. That is, these are societies in which the public is not free to have opinions. It only is allowed to have the opinions that the regime approves of. And you can send in poll takers and ask people what they think, but it's not only a matter of the oppression. It's a matter that we see in countries, for example, the countries of Eastern Europe that have recently come out from under communism, that in the very first elections, the first year of or two of people who have not been living under a free press where they could hear ideas debated freely, that the parties that often take great many votes are very peculiar parties that sound all kinds of odd extremist and nationalist themes.
I want to put that point to Marina Ottaway. What about it? We just gave them a little oxygen of, run the tanks through and put up the liberation flag and they'll be fine.
Look what is happening in countries that have allowed elections recently. Look at the case of Turkey. We have an Islamist party that won the elections there. We have Islamist parties
but
that
But it's a democracy.
Well, but the Islamist party in Turkey is not proposing Islamism.
That's what we hope they will not propose. We were not sure about it until very recently. And even now we are not quite sure.
Marina Ottaway, Joshua Muravchik, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Hossam is on the line. Hi, Hossam. You're on the air. Hossam, are you there? That looks like we lost him. Let's turn to Mawata, calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the fundamental of democracy is fair representation and good governance. That's what we want. And there's got to be an element of peace. That's what everybody wants in the world, just like it is in the United States. But going into Iraq, dropping bombs and firing bullets, spreading bullets around, that's not going to bring peace. That's not the way you preach peace. I think the United States has a golden opportunity here to go around the world and preach about peace. Find a way, a peaceful way, of cementing the fundamentals of democracy, not by going in there by force, because that's the same thing that the United States doesn't want the government, the despotic government, to do.
But Umwata, what are you suggesting, that we just send Saddam Hussein a nice letter and ask him to move out and make way for democracy?
There are so many ways that the United States has done in the past to remove people from power. They can use some of those ways. Why put some innocent families in pain by innocent death? I mean, these people are not even. These are the people that want peace in the first place.
Mwata, we've got it, and we understand your question. I want to put it to Josh Moravcik. How about it? Is war any way to start a democratic tsunami?
Absolutely. The United States has a terrific record of successfully implanting democracy by means of military occupation. We did it in Japan, we did it in Germany, we did it in Italy, we did it in Austria, and we did it in Grenada and so on. So it works very well. It seems counterintuitive. You think, well, that you can't do it by military means, but in fact, you can.
Marina Ottaway, let me put the same question to you. What about the post-Cold War record of U.S. Implementation of democracy at gunpoint?
We have the example of Germany and Japan, which is certainly a positive example. Mm-hmm. Let us not forget that some of the countries where the United States has intervened most often, most repeatedly, and for the longest period of time, are still struggling to establish democratic systems. Like the Philippines, Haiti is a disaster. Nicaragua has barely made the transition.
No,
I think one should be very careful not to extrapolate from two successful cases.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on Mwata's point about peace and the safety of people. Today, the UN, a report was leaked about casualties in Iraq that the UN prepared, and they envision as many as 500,000 Iraqi civilians either injured or put in privation by a U.S. attack. Now, how in God's name do you begin to democratize after doing that to 500,000 people?
Of course, Hiroshima went down and Japan went democratic.
Well, that's true, but, you know, the U.S. essentially put we still have our troops there. Are we willing, if it make a 50-year commitment
our
to
our troops are no longer imposing or enforcing democracy in Japan, though.
No, but they're there as part of the reason why Japan was important to us as a Cold War counter. Do we have that kind of stake in Iraq? I don't think so.
Josh Moravcik?
I don't know who that other voice was, but
that's Jack Beatty, our analyst here.
He made a hilarious point before that he said, "Look, we're still in Japan, we're still in Germany, and if we're still in Iraq, the people will hate us." But the people in Germany and Japan don't hate us.
Yes, but there isn't fundamentalism.
There is a lot of resentment
in the air, as there is in the Middle East.
Well,
yeah. And it's not exactly all roses in South Korea, I guess today.
Germany and Japan.
There is a tremendous resentment.
Before we got there. I mean, Germany and Japan were not a given. They are what they are because we're there and because we went there.
We've got a lot more to talk about. We've got a break coming up. We are looking at democratic dreams and delusions in the Middle East. Which is more threatening, the false and dangerous stability of Arab autocracy or democratic revolution in the Middle East? And beyond oil, what should America be fighting for in the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about democratic dreams and delusions in the Middle East. Is this talk about democracy a genuine hope, or is it hypocrisy? And if we can't encourage democracy in the Middle East, are we doomed to see more 9/11s from furious, frustrated Arabs? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests are Marina Ottaway, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Joshua Moravcik, Resident Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Hossam is on the line. Welcome, Hossam. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention the way that we're talking about Western democracy like some sort of holy grail that we should all strive towards,
mm-hmm.
and we're talking about Islam or Islamic parties like something that's completely unacceptable. I mean, in reality, Islam is a complete democratic political system. It's a different flavor from the Western world democratic system, but it is a democratic system.
Osama, are you suggesting then that the Middle East is already democratic and we just haven't noticed?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I don't. Besides maybe Iran inside its political system, I don't see too many Islamic countries are in reality in the Middle East.
So then even in Islamic terms, there's a shortfall from an Islamic democracy. Can the United States help promote that? Or should it?
The way that it's going, the impression that I'm getting is that basically the United States needs new markets to sell its products to. It needs the oil. It's basically only economic reasons for this.
But I want to get to your point because it's such an interesting one. It's really maybe the nub here. You're saying don't impose democracy from outside because there's a whole and sufficient Islamic system which includes democracy. You're also saying that democracy isn't there now.
Yes.
So can and should the United States help promote that?
I think the United States, in my opinion, should just stop interfering, and in due course, the people over there are going to strive towards that as a natural progression. We're all humans. We're all families trying to raise our families and everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants democracy, as that they're calling here. But I don't think we're giving the chance. There's too many interference all the time, especially with the Israeli situation.
Hossam, stand by if you would. Joshua Moravchuk, how about it? Hossam says just stay out and let Arabs work it out in their own good time.
Well, I mean, there are two things about that. It would certainly be true that we should stay out in terms of military intervention were it not for the fact that we're faced with these terrible threats by Saddam Hussein's proven aggressiveness and his pursuit of weapons of mass destruction and by these terrorist networks that are based there. And so that's what brings us in a military sense. I don't think I or anybody, even the most radical Democrat of my ilk, would advocate that we should take military measures only for the purpose of democratization if there were no military threat that were confronting us that we have to deal with. But in addition to that, even if there were no military issue, I would say we should still intervene non-militarily by trying to broadcast to those areas, by doing exchanges, by our diplomacy and our economic aid policy to try to encourage democratization, as we have done in all the rest of the world.
And Marina Ottaway, what about Hossam's point that Islamic democracy in the Islamic nations of the Middle East may simply not be a flavor we recognize, and that if we try and impose Western democracy, this may be an alien institution? We simply may be constitutionally incapable of offering the political system the democracy they want or need.
Well, let me first of all point out that the point of view that the caller expressed mm-hmm. is the one that you hear over and over again in the press or, you know, from people you talk to in the area and so on. It's a very typical point of view.
Thank you for bringing that to us,
Osama. Stay out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The second point is, the United States does not recognize the existence of democracy except democracy as we conceive of it, and certainly does not, and I think correctly so in this case, mm-hmm. cannot conceive of the idea of an Islamic democracy, because the Islamist political systems we have seen installed in countries like Iran are certainly not a democratic political systems. And here I think we are absolutely right.
And when you say an Islamic democracy, you don't mean a democracy in an Islamic country, you rather mean democracy as an expression
based
directly of the Quran.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we recognize the existence of the possibility of a system which is both democratic and based on the precepts of the Quran. And certainly we have not seen any examples of those.
So I guess what you're saying is, if Hossam recognizes or represents the mainstream Islamic view, you're refuting it.
No, well, I'm refuting part of it. Mm-hmm. I'm refuting the fact that Arab countries, by turning to Islam, would develop democratic systems.
Mm. Got it.
There are other tendencies in these countries that might, in the long run, bring about a democracy. I think it's important not to confuse the possibility of a long-term transition to democracy, which I think it's possible everywhere, mm-hmm. and the idea that the United States can precipitate that change change by intervening in the Middle in Iraq.
And that time frame is at this point
different things.
And that's a very short term or almost immediate intervention. Potentially, Axel is on the line. Hi, Axel, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I would like to comment on what Jack Beatty said earlier when he said that if we allow democracy in these countries, the Islamists would take over. In fact, in my opinion, that's exactly what these dictatorships in these countries want the West to believe. I am a Berber from Algeria, and I know what's going on in, and I'm sure you know what's going on in Algeria. There is a big democratic movement in addition to all of the Islamists and so on. And
but
so
Axel, Algeria is held up as the nightmare scenario of what happens when democracy is introduced and a country slides into kind of a Islamic bloodbath.
Yeah, well, it's if we saying that the Islamists won, I don't think that's quite right, because you have to see the whole picture. How did they win and how that came? In fact, it's the regime in place that wanted Algerians to believe that if they don't win, the Islamists would win. Mm-hmm. And they played on the numbers. And in fact, the Islamists won 2 million votes out of 14 million. So you cannot say that they have a popular vote.
So your voice of the Algerian says real democracy may, in fact, be an antidote to that kind of radical Islamist presence.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the thing is, unfortunately, the West and even the United States and the whole West doesn't really support effectively democratic movement in these countries. I have just one question. Why is it when Milosevic lost elections in Yugoslavia and he wanted to stay in power, the West intervened and forced him out, and whereas in Algeria, last year we had 2 million people who demonstrated in Algiers from the Berber movement against the government, and all what the government did is started killing people, and the West didn't say anything.
Actually, it's a tough question and a bigger one than we're going to be able to answer tonight, but we take your core point. Josh Morovcik, we're almost out of time here, but your final thought, is this tsunami still a possibility?
Oh, I think that it's a very significant possibility that if we get democratization by our own doing in Iraq, and that in turn triggers the revolution that's sort of throbbing beneath the surface in Iran right now, that these are two of the three most influential countries of the Muslim Middle East.
And yet we're hearing a lot of headwinds tonight. Josh Morovcik, I want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Josh Morovcik is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of The Imperative of American Leadership. Marina Ottaway, and thank you so much for your perspective tonight and all the research that you've brought to this subject. Marina Ottaway is senior associate and co-director at the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Marina, thanks for joining us.
And thank you to you for having me.
And Jack Beatty, here I am rushing to try and give you time for a last word. Take it, my friend.
Oh, I don't want to unfairly tip the scales, but I just do think that, you know, if we have to choose between oil, which equals stability, and democracy, which for the other regimes equal instability, I have no doubt on what side we're going to come down. It'll be business as usual in Saudi Arabia, business as usual with our friends in Egypt. Our interest there, we'd like democracy, and by God, I agree with our caller, the Berber, who said that they can work it out themselves, but we also have our motives are oil and strategy.
We'll know soon, and stability, and not more 9/11s. It's a tricky chemistry. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a journalist goes to boot camp. This is On Point. Since the Vietnam War, the U.S. military has been cautious about media coverage. It's been a far cry from Ernie Pyle in uniform reporting from the foxholes and battleships of World War II During the 1991 Gulf War, reporters complained that the closest they could get to the front lines was the Pentagon press room. Now the U.S. military is gearing up for possible combat and in Iraq, and the brass is inching toward a closer relationship with the media. Last month, a group of 60 journalists spent a week at Fort Benning, Georgia, for an intensive crash course in combat survival. Among the lessons, how to react to enemy fire, how to protect against chemical weapons, and how to avoid landmines. The training suggests that reporters may cover the next war from the front lines. Stan Kroc, national security correspondent for Business Week magazine, was one of the journalists at the training camp. In this radio diary, he reflects on the experience there.
The days were really rigorous. They usually started at 5 o'clock or so. We had to get up for physical training. We had to assemble at 4:45, so we got up even earlier than that, like at 4:44. And they went till usually later than 10 at night. We did everything from riding Black Hawk helicopters and go up in C-130s for parachute jumps. We were in camouflage. We went out with a squad. We had Kevlar helmets and Gore-Tex camouflage outfits, and there was a kind of halo around our helmet which had laser receptors, and we wore a vest with other laser receptors. We knew if we were hit because we'd start to beep. And the squad we went out with and the enemy were using blanks. So it sounded like live fire, but they were blanks. And it was very different from laser tag. You got a real sense of the reality of it. Your adrenaline started to flow. You somehow went into this zone where you felt this was as close as we're going to come to what it will be really like. And we have to make very sure we don't put the soldiers at risk or ourselves at risk. For me, the most frightening thing was the Black Hawk helicopter. I have claustrophobia, and it's very close quarters, so the good news was that they didn't close the doors, but the bad news was that they didn't close the doors, because we were up at 120 feet. When they start banking, and you are on the outside, on the downside of when they're banking, you just hope those seat belts work, and they don't have hanger straps or anything like that to grab onto, so I was holding onto the bottom of my seat and trying to look out the other way, the upside, instead of the ground stretching before me on my side of the helicopter. For some others, I think the most difficult part might have been going into a tear gas chamber. We were fully clothed from gas mask to boots in protective gear. They didn't let me take off my face mask because of the heart murmur to breathe in the tear gas. But others did, and a lot of them got sick afterwards. It was pretty awful stuff. Even though I didn't take anything off, my face was burning. From talking to some of the young soldiers, and they all look like they were just from their junior prom, they think they're invincible. They have no sense of their own mortality. And that they were ultimately, potentially, putting their own lives at risk, I think is something that just doesn't register, can't be internalized by kids that age. It's why you have so many horrible traffic accidents from kids who only recently got their licenses. They don't think it can happen to them, but it can. And as a parent, I was a little heartsick about that. I'm 52 years old. I've got a bulging disc on my nerve, claustrophobia, and a little bit of a heart murmur. I'm not sure I'm a prime candidate to be with the troops on the front line. But I do think it's important, if I'm writing from an armchair in Washington, to know what it is they're doing, what their equipment is, how they work, how the equipment works and how the troops work. And just to get a sense of them, and that's really why I went. I think you can write without that sense, but it just grounds you so much better to have it.
Stan Kroc covers national security for Business Week magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.